So for those of you at home listening to this, this is the second part of a two-part series, again, at EAU in Paris. We're here with Matt Gowski. We had a joint session. We talked about ctDNA a second ago. We presented it at the meeting today. And Matt and his team then presented the adjuvant survival signal for nivolumab. Those of you at home will recognize that this is something that we've not just been waiting for today, but perhaps a little bit longer.
Certainly, it's a rare podcast with Matt that you don't bring it up.
I'm never going to talk about it again because I thought it was terrific. I don't know why you've been hiding this bushel for such a long period of time, Matt.
Well,
I thought, you know,
I would have shown it on day one.
I'd have shown it on day one. I said, look at this, everyone. Isn't it fabulous? Isn't it fabulous? I would have used words like fabulous. I thought you were fabulous today, by the way.
Thank you. That's very kind.
So, Matt, why don't you summarize maybe where we stood data-wise for this study before today, and then obviously the data presented.
So CheckMate 274 is a quick reminder, randomized Nevo versus placebo in patients with muscle-invasive urothelial cancer at high risk for recurrence after radical surgery. The co-primary endpoints were disease-free survival in the all-comer population and in patients with tumors with high PD-L1 expression. And overall survival was a secondary endpoint. It's a secondary endpoint with statistical rigor, which I think is, you know, we're seeing a trend in doing that, but I think that's had implications and explains in part why you haven't seen the data yet. So we saw the DFS data at the first analysis presented several years ago, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And then we saw three-year DFS data more recently, and now we're seeing OS data. So the OS data are from interim analyses. And so the statistical analysis plan uses a hierarchical statistical testing, which is applied separately to patients with, separately to the intent to treat population and to patients with high tumor PD-L1 expression in their event driven. So those analyses could occur at different times. So today, the interim analyses data from prior interim analyses were presented. Those analyses did not meet the pre-specified thresholds for statistical significance. So again, secondary endpoint, but had to meet statistical significance with recycled alpha, et cetera. So didn't meet significance. And so overall survival follow-up continues for the final analysis. But if you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves and the effect sizes, the effects are going in the same direction as all of the other analyses, and the effect sizes seem really quite consistent with all the other endpoints. And those endpoints include the primary endpoints of disease-free survival, but other endpoints like non-urothelial tract recurrence-free survival and distant metastases-free survival. So in the intent-to-treat population, the median overall survival was 69.5 months with Nevo and 50.1 months with placebo for a hazard ratio of 0.76, confidence interval 0.61 to 0.96. And in patients with tumors with high PD-L1 expression, the median OS wasn't reached in either arm, but the 36-month OS rate was 71.3% with Nevo and 56.6% with placebo. Hazard ratio there was 0.56 with confidence intervals of 0.36 to 0.86.
So Matt, just to clarify, in your ITT, even though the upper bound of your hazard ratio was less than one, it wasn't significant?
That's right, because, you know, two-sided testing using more rigorous thresholds for a statistical significance at the interim looks, as, you know, we've seen before. So it's not simply a, 0.05 p-value. Mm-hmm.
And Matt, do the subset analysis for us before. I've been interested in the past in the neoadjuvant cohort chemotherapy and the upper tract cohort, both of which from a PFS perspective appeared to do less well with immune therapy.
Yeah, and so I think from an OS subset analysis standpoint, it really points maybe towards the danger in some of those analyses. So you know, for the slate of origin analysis in patients with bladder primaries, the effect size, the hazard ratio was 0.71. In patients with renal pelvis tumors, the next most common, the hazard ratio was 0.67. And in patients with ureteral primary tumors, which were less frequent, the hazard ratio was 3.93. So you can see from that that the upper tract story is not straightforward. 0.67 for renal pelvis, 3.93 for ureter. Is that really biology or is that some noise? So yeah. I'm not sure what's going on there.
I think it changes my thinking on that. I agree with you.
And then the cisplatin thing, you know, similarly, that the effect size was slightly larger in patients with prior neoadjuvant chemotherapy, but not markedly so.
And Matt, the PD-L1 biomarker, you know, I hate it. I'll be honest with you. I've been trying to bury it. I don't know how long. And I feel that when the EMA made their original decision to go with the biomarker and not the biomarker negative population, and you didn't show the hazard ratio for the biomarker negative population in your forest plot, I'm guessing I feel the EMA probably, you know, it makes sense to me. Because if you're 0.5 in the biomarker positive population and you're 0.7 in the biomarker in the ITT population, you're probably going to be 0.85 or 0.9 in the biomarker negative population. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, now I can remember if the data has been shown.
It's not been shown.
No, not for OS, but for DFS, we have looked at that, and now I'm trying to remember if it's ever been shown.
Don't say it right now. Let's not do it. But the principle is that I can see where the EMA are coming from, in that you kind of look at this. Now that depends, and so the US FDA all comers, European biomarker positives, which one's got it right? And don't go with the Americans because you're American, please.
Well, I would say that depends on where your comfort lies. Does your comfort lie in missing some patients who would benefit with the cost of treating everyone? Or does it lie in making sure it's a specificity sensitivity issue, probably? And there's unfortunately both toxicity costs, but maybe more importantly, financial costs associated with that decision.
Do you believe the biomarker here, or do you think this is a flash in the pan biomarker result? We've done 10 biomarker trials. They've not been successful.
The leading PD-L1.
Yeah. So there've been lots of, we've struggled a lot with this biomarker. Suddenly this biomarker results come out. It's not the only primary endpoint. The primary endpoint was in the ITT population. Yeah. So, you know, how do we deal with this problem now? Because it is a problem.
Yeah.
Do we revive the biomarker or do we kill it?
I mean, I think the biomarker in this program has performed fairly well, not completely consistently, but it's performed fairly well. And I think in your Invigor 10 data in the ctDNA positive group, there was an enrichment in the effect of adjuvant atezolizumab patients with high PD-L1 expression. So I think a lot of the data does go in the right direction for PD-L1. It's just that it's inconsistent enough that for these major treatment decisions, it still makes me feel a bit uncomfortable.
If you had to use the PD-L1, sorry, Brian, you go. I'm getting excited.
I'm used to it. Do you ever use PD-L1 staining in clinical practice? So do you have a patient where I'm not sure, or I don't know, maybe they have some low-grade inflammatory process, you're worried about toxicity or whatever.
Yeah,
and you say, I'm going to check PD-L1 because that's going to put me over the edge.
Yeah, so I would say once in a while it comes up, and it comes up in patients who are really borderline chemotherapy candidates. And I've used it in that setting.
We have to use it, Brian.
I was just asking Matt. I've used it once, but I'm just wondering if that makes sense or not. And then my next question is, harkening back to part one of this podcast, what's the intersection then of ctDNA positivity and PD-L1 staining?
Well, ctDNA is much better.
Wasn't asking you, but okay.
People are going to get sick of me saying this, but I think one's a prognostic biomarker and one's a predictive biomarker. ctDNA tells us who needs treatment, not who benefits from treatment. PD-L1 testing might tell us who benefits from treatment. So if you don't have micrometastatic disease, there's no way you could benefit from treatment because you don't need it.
Sure.
So I think potentially complementary, but I would say it's much lower hanging fruit to probably identify patients who need treatment versus those who benefit.
Matt, sure. In this environment, after adjuvant therapy, you would expect in the placebo arm, you'd expect the majority of patients to get first-line metastatic systemic therapy. In urothelial cancer, I'm afraid the answer is not everyone. And it's not like prostate cancer or some other tumors where know, there are some patients who really struggle because relapses can be quick and devastating. In this study, you of the 60% of patients who relapsed, about 25% got subsequent immune therapy, and about 20% got subsequent platinum-based chemotherapy. It was actually more patients getting immune therapy than platinum-based chemotherapy, because, you know, platinum-based chemotherapy, I guess you would think, is or has been more of a standard of care than immune therapy at relapse. What do you make of those numbers? Do you think they're reasonable? Do you think they're representative? And do you think the immune therapy proportion of patients who got immune therapy should be higher?
So I presented some of that data in the past, so I'll take the hit for this comment, but I don't think any of us are doing those analyses correctly. This isn't a proportion, but it's a rate. It's a time-dependent event. And so really, mm-hmm. to test this or to answer that question, we need to determine the cumulative probability of receiving immunotherapy with competing risks, right? If someone dies, unfortunately, before they can get further treatment, then they can't, by definition, get further treatment. And we need to see where that curve plateaus, and the plateau in that curve is the answer to your question. We don't have that. We have a random time point in saying that at this time point of those patients, you know, who's gotten treatment. So I think that number is reasonable for the way that the data has been analyzed.
I guess some people are going to say that number's lower than they'd like to see. You know, they'd like to see half the patients in the control arm at least getting subsequent chemotherapy and immune therapy. Do you think that that number will evolve with time as the data matures?
I think it will, absolutely. I think you know, we have 3-year median follow-up data now, but that data on subsequent treatment lags behind that data.
So Matt, were these survival data, did they just reinforce your thoughts in practice, or did they change them at all?
No, they reinforce them. I mean, I think we have to take the data for what it is. I would say that if we saw this data as a secondary endpoint in studies that don't place hypothesis testing around secondary endpoints, everyone would say, oh, that's great, goes in the same direction, it's significant for a secondary endpoint, and that'd be the end of the day. But this is a secondary endpoint with pre-specified hypothesis testing, and so we have to respect that. And by that, it has not reached the threshold for significance.
So, Matt, there's a drug called pembrolizumab. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's used quite widely. They've done a similar study called Ambassador 250. I think you may have heard that study. And that trial had an OS hazard ratio of 0.98. We've not seen...
in fact, the opposite was true.
We had a positive OS signal for pembrolizumab and a negative signal for nivolumab. And Brian, we've done podcasts with that before, and we've struggled to come to a conclusion as to why that might be the case. Most people believe there are more similarities than differences between these drugs. Do you think nivolumab is a better drug than pembrolizumab? And if that's not the case, why have we seen, is this just a flash in the pan again, or is something else going on?
So I saw a bunch of tweets today about the drug, the biomarker.
Not mine. That's for you and you and I were at lunch while they were tweeting. Which, by the way, dinner last night was lovely. By the way. Thank you. Formally, thank you for buying me dinner last night.
my pleasure. It didn't have anything to do with you not grilling me today on that. lots of chatter about the differences in the drugs, the biomarkers. I think really we have to think about the trials themselves, the design, and mm-hmm. really scrutinize what happened on these studies. And, you know, I think similar to Invigor 10, an open label adjuvant study, if you look at the early dropouts on both of those studies, it's really quite high. You know, patients get randomized, they decide that they don't want to participate, and those patients are censored right after randomization. There were a fair number of patients on Ambassador as well who actually started immunotherapy before recurrence on the observation arm, I think, in light of some of the the CheckMate 274 data that came out around the time. So I think there are differences in the conduct of these studies that could potentially impact the results.
If I've got the opportunity to answer my own question, can I do that, Brian? Is that okay? Do I have permission to
do we
that?
Have a choice?
I don't know. You could. I think we should have a veto on these things where you can just start vetoing. I think that would be fun.
I would love that, actually. We'll talk offline.
You guys need some of those. You need some of those sound effects like they have on morning radio.
Yes, good idea. Put it in the suggestion box.
I think our IT skills for these podcasts are pretty poor. Actually, we're struggling with just hearing each other, let alone that next dimension. So the difference for me between the Nevo Pembro story and renal cancer is 914 was negative for PFS and OS, whereas in Ambassador was exactly the same for PFS. And then there was a lot of censoring on the OS curve. And so and PFS, I think, is a more accurate endpoint than OS. There may be an issue about subsequent therapy, which I think is something which could explain the differences between the two. But I agree with you, Matt. I think that both those trials essentially show the same thing. My concern is around that censoring in an open label trial. And we know, that investigator initiated trials, we've all on the call done many of them, it's more difficult to collect that data robustly over years. The budgets are lower, the monitoring is less robust. And that probably applies for subsequent therapies as well, by the way.
Yeah.
And so my interpretation of this is that Ambassador study showed a really good DFS signal, and I'm not convinced that OS signal is robust. And so I don't think it's the same story as renal cancer.
So I was going to clarify, Tom, you're saying that the data sets in bladder cancer really are similar. There's not these, whereas in renal cancer, we're sort of left wondering why was ipi-nevo-nevo and atezo negative when pembro was positive.
Yeah, I think the DFS is 0.71 and 0.70 for the two trials, and one OS is 0.98 and the other 0.7, and one's a commercial open label trial. So that's my take on those issues. Matt, I've got a question for you, and I guess it's looking into the future, and it's about these neoadjuvant trials that are coming out. I've been pretty negative about the OS signal in Nevo. I didn't think it was going to be as good as this. And I felt that if we
sounds
got...
Like you owe Matt an apology, it sounds like.
I think maybe I owe all the patients an apology for getting it wrong again. That might be a more appropriate apology. As I said before, I genuinely do think it's okay to broadcast secondary endpoints. I genuinely do think, even with hindsight, that once you have an FDA and EMA approved drug, it's important to release your OS signal. And so I don't regret what I was saying before. I'm frustrated a little bit that I'm frustrated. We don't normally have whistling on the show. And I don't know, that was probably Brian. I don't know. Brian's got a dog, actually. He's got a new dog. I don't know if that was Brian or
no, Matt. That was me.
Oh yes, Brian wasn't up to around the applause, but there is an applause for these data. So the point I'm trying to make very slowly, and I apologise, is that if these neoadjuvant trials have an OS signal and a DFS signal, but you've got, I don't think you've got significant OS, and there are some caveats, we've talked about those caveats, we've talked about the toxicity and the selection of patients, et cetera, and I think it is important we do, but nevertheless, what results do we need to see now to supersede adjuvant Nevo? Because it's very easy to say you don't have to give the neoadjuvant period. You can just give the adjuvant signals period and you get a sort of an OS trend in that. Is it significant OS you need now? Is that necessary?
So I think that obviously would be helpful. I think it's going to depend a little bit on the effect size for EFS. And even though we say that PathCR isn't a great endpoint and all of that, and it's not a great endpoint in and of itself, but I think if the PathCR rates are coming in super high, plus the effect size for EFS is high, that would help one justify the neoadjuvant component as well.
Matt, if you've had neoadjuvant, let's say it comes in with a survival signal these neoadjuvant trials and they're positive for DFS with a 0.50 and OS for 0.70, but you're ctDNA negative post-surgery, do you think you should continue on the adjuvant period? Or do you think with that low relapse rate that actually it's time to stop?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. Hopefully, you know, the data to answer that question definitively won't be generated from those studies, but hopefully we'll have some data from the control arm and from the treatment arm in terms of ctDNA status from those studies to help at least inform that. But yeah, I mean, I think you make a great point, and that's, I think, what...
First time, a whole podcast.
In 3 years. That's the first time in 3 years.
No. It was clear. There was one about 3 podcasts ago, someone said, that's a good point, Tom. I remember that.
But you can imagine that's the next generation of studies, right? If neoadjuvant is adopted.
Absolutely.
Then it's you know, randomizing the ctDNA negative and positive, kind of like your modern trial, but with the neoadjuvant component.
Sorry about you.
No, I think those might have to be sort of academic studies.
Yeah, sure. Agreed.
Yeah, but if Invigor 11 comes in and we see more granularity on that data and your relapse rate, if you're CTA negative, is that the dog biting, Brian?
Yes.
I thought what I said was painful. I didn't think it was that bad. I sometimes get criticism, but it's unusual if you go, ow, that was really bad. I think that if Invigor 11, if that trial is positive and it shows that the relapse data is about 10 to 15% in that biomarker negative population, for lots of different reasons, it's going to be difficult to say, you know, that adjuvant period should be all comers. I think it's going to be, I don't know whether people say, you know, we should be using a atezolizumab in this population if the pembrolizumab trials are positive. I think it's going to be a very complicated area. And I think Invigor 11 will be positive for DFS because it's going against placebo and everything we know at the moment suggests that that should work.
Yeah, I would be surprised if that study isn't positive, but we'll be interesting to see.
Well, and especially, Tom, if you can salvage patients who convert to ctDNA positivity, right, then it even strengthens the argument not to give adjuvant in that setting.
I think that would be a cool endpoint, and that comes back to some of the other studies. Matt, what is the next generation of studies in the adjuvant space in view of what we've seen before? Should we be looking at patients like EV Pembro, I think, is going to be in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant space soon. Should we be looking at sequencing new drugs after that? Should we be focusing only on the ctDNA positive populations? Is there a second generation of immune drugs? Clearly, you've got your LAG-3 study that you've got running. What happens next in the adjuvant space? Or is it actually just a case of saying we ought to just sit down and wait for these neoadjuvant trials to read out because it's going to be so confusing?
Well, I think two things. One, we should think a little bit about what the future could look like with neoadjuvant EV Pembro. And I think in the adjuvant setting, in that case, both the use of ctDNA to determine who needs treatment and interrogation of the specimen to decide who benefits from what treatment is going to be needed. And we have more and more options. And so I think those need to be tested in small proof of concept studies in the adjuvant setting, where we could never do that before because we didn't have measures of disease activity in the adjuvant setting to know if patients were benefiting and had to do these big randomized studies. But could you do a small study in patients with HER2-positive residual disease after neoadjuvant EV Pembro who are ctDNA positive, looking at clearance of ctDNA with an anti-HER2 ADC? Yeah, sure, you could do that study, and that could represent, you know, the future.
And it's a better place than third or fourth line therapy where the biology is no longer relevant from the tissue and they've been had with so many different treatments that it's impossible to get a heterogeneous population. It's a very clean study to do that. Matt, I've got to go. I'm going to debate. I think it's a debate with Seth Lerner. I'm slightly concerned about it. He's I haven't actually prepared that much. I'm planning later on this evening. I'm debating with him about the chemo rad trial, which the I think it was Alliance trial. I could be wrong. It could be SWOG. I think it might be SWOG. I'm not sure. It's chemo rad with Pembro versus chemo rad alone, muscle invasive bladder cancer. He's going to talk about the merits of that study. What is the meaning of what does that, what, how does that study add to what else we have? I guess we're going to get the results in about 18 months or something along those lines. And what does a positive study look like?
So I think that's SWOG 1806, if
yeah.
I remember that.
Yes, it is. I don't think I described it very well.
Wrong cropper group and wrong drug. But
yeah, one of the right concerns is I am debating it in 24 hours. Yeah. So if you are at Paris, I would definitely come to that session.
That's with Atiza. So, I think those study, that generation of studies, and there's one similarly designed with Pembro, I think they're gambles in the sense that we don't actually know how well immune checkpoint blockade combines with chemoradiation before jumping into these big phase three studies. We have some phase two data sets, but they're not huge. So I think there's some gamble there. On the other hand, if those studies are positive, I think that could be the tipping point that's needed to really bring trimodality therapy, chemoradiation to another level in terms of standard treatment, because it's never had that huge, powerful study behind it with a modern mm-hmm. drug that really gets the message out in a different way than some of the trials that have been done before.
I'm quite pleased they did a randomized phase three, because I think the phase two and the single arm phase two, we've done too many investigator-initiated studies which haven't been successful in that sort of environment. I've done many of those studies myself, of course. But so I'm not being more broadly critical, but I think it's fabulous that they've managed to get this over the line. And I agree with you. We spoke to Mikael van Heijden a couple of podcasts ago, and I was being a bit critical, saying we haven't had any robust radiotherapy data since the early 2000s, really. Yeah. And this will give us perspective. Trimodality data with or without Pembro. And so I think it's potentially, we don't talk enough about that study, but it needs to be, I think, brought into the mix.
Well, and I think, as Matt said, it introduces trimodality now with more exciting drugs, right? With modern systemic therapy.
I'm not still excited about cisplatin, Brian. I'm still excited.
Hey, Matt. Fabulous. Thank you. I'm sorry you had to have dinner with Tom and Paris. Yeah. Please tape the debate for me. I want to see it.
I'll see you soon.
Interesting data.
Matt, thanks a lot. Brian, I'll see you soon. Good luck with that dog.
Thanks. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.